The following is for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth, and we have newsmakers, experts, and reporters to bring you these stories.
Dueling over default, candidate Romney joins the GOP attack on growing deficits and lingering recession under Obama with the debt ceiling held hostage.
Know thine enemy. A Vietnam vet goes back to understand the psychology of our enemy then and how it applies to the terror war today.
Can Do, C-A-N-N-E-S, that is. Our critic is back from the annual French Film Festival.
Sure of her country, jazz legend Diane Shore puts a Nashville notch in her belt with a new CD called The Gathering.
The Madness of King Bobby, a new HBO documentary, paints paranoia and obsession as keys to success for Cold War chess hero Bobby Fischer and to his downfall.
Plus notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for your ears only, a production of Gatewave Incorporated, the nonprofit volunteer 24/7 radio reading service for those with disabilities. For your ears only, for the week of June 6th, D-Day, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth.
We're going to raise the debt limit. The spending cut should exceed the increase in the debt limit. Otherwise, it'll serve to cost us jobs in our country. That's not what the American people want.
It breaks my heart to see what's happening to this great country. These failing hopes make up President Obama's own misery index. It's never been higher. And what's his answer? He says this, I'm just getting started. No, Mr. President, you've had your chance. We, the people on this farm and citizens across the country, are the ones who are just getting started.
House Speaker John Boehner and former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney, finally a formally announced presidential candidate, were only two of the Republicans attacking President Obama's economic policies and spending priorities last week, with the nation's debt ceiling and key credit ratings held hostage. The threat of a default on U.S. debts, both foreign and domestic, has not so far prompted a compromise across partisan and ideological lines on Capitol Hill.
And last week's depressing economic news only escalates the debate. Housing prices continue to disappoint, as did factory output and retail sales. And the Labor Department reported only 54,000 additional non-farm payroll jobs in May, just a third of the total expected, edging the unemployment rate back up from 9 to 9.1%. To consider the implications of those reports, debt ceiling politics, the Romney candidacy, and more, for your ears only, we're joined again by Julian Zelizer, Princeton University Professor of History and Public Affairs. His books include Arsenal of Democracy, Jimmy Carter, and the Presidency of George W. Bush. Welcome back to our program.
Thanks for having me.
Budget battles are nothing new for Congress, but you wrote recently about how the process has grown more dysfunctional in recent years, despite major reforms in 1974, 1985, and 1990. What are the new factors working against necessary compromise?
Well, one is just the intense hyper-partisanship that we're seeing on Capitol Hill, and it's leading right now members of the Republican Party to play a game of chicken with the budget, everything from shutting down the government a few months ago to now not raising the debt ceiling. I think that combined with the 24-hour media cycle, which does feed on this kind of a story, has created a situation where an already difficult and decentralized budgeting process that we have is becoming even more dangerous and explosive.
A GOP holdout that shut much of the federal government in 1995-96 did most damage to the party itself at election time. But some see more dire consequences for the country from market reaction to default following a failure to raise the debt ceiling. What's your view?
Yeah, I think there's a much bigger danger this time around. Shutting down the government is not good. It had bad consequences, and it ultimately played badly for the Republican Party. But not raising the debt ceiling can cause the kind of financial chaos that would bring the country down, and I think in the end would be bad for both parties politically, but for all Americans. So the threat is much more serious here if they actually followed through on this.
A man much associated with the earlier government shutdown is back again as a presidential candidate, former House Speaker Newt Gingrich. And he's already paid a price for typically outspoken commentary, essentially apologizing for criticizing GOP-backed Medicare reform in the House. You say his record on governance should also be kept in mind.
Yeah, well, being Speaker of the House is different than being President, but if we look back at when he was Speaker, he had a lot of problems. He had trouble in terms of his discussions and presentation with the media. He wasn't very good at controlling members of his own party, and he was a bit reckless politically. So, you know, that's the kind of experience we want to look for, and I think Gingrich raises a lot of red flags just in terms of how he governed when he had a position of power.
Romney has a much more solid record in business and government, but his greatest achievement in Massachusetts is also his biggest vulnerability, health care reform, much like what President Obama supported. How do you think Romney handled the issue last week?
I think okay. I think in general he's been too defensive about it. Recently he's been a little more forthcoming that this is his bill, that was his program, even if it wasn't perfect. And I think in general Romney has to own up to the health care reform he passed in Massachusetts and use it to his advantage rather than constantly defending himself. And he has to say, you know, that he found a model that works better than Obama's or whatever the argument is. But he can't escape from the fact that he was governor and he passed that program. People will remind him about it endlessly. So it's a bad strategy to just play defense.
Romney stressed job growth more than budget cuts last week. How do you see him doing with the party's conservative core that's now so focused on spending and tax reduction?
It will be a push. I mean, the party right now wants to focus on cutting government, and as much as they criticize Obama, they don't have a plan to grow jobs. You know, I think the answer for the Republicans to at least be competitive is to have a candidate who has a vision about how to grow jobs. And if all they say is cut government, what we've seen in the last few weeks is that doesn't play well with Americans either. So Romney's on the right track with that, but he's going to need to follow that up with concrete ideas.
What is the history of job growth when it comes to either beneficial tax policies for the investors that the Republicans keep talking about and the consumption of ordinary people that most business owners look to decide whether to hire more people, whether to make more production?
There's not always a clear correlation between low taxes and good economic times. I mean, the fact is, one of the best periods in American history was the 40s and 50s and early 60s, when high tax rates were at about 90% for individuals. Corporate taxes were well over 50%, and the government and the economy did just fine. So I don't think the evidence is there that the tax cuts always lead to economic growth. Also in 1993, Congress and Clinton raised taxes, and we had one of the best economic periods that followed.
New polling shows Romney, Sarah Palin, and former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani is most favored by Republicans, though each with only low double digits. And majorities of all voters who know about them say there's no chance they would vote for Palin, Gingrich, or Ron Paul. Still, Palin's rambling bus tour stole much of the spotlight from Romney last week. How do you see the Republican presidential field finally filling out and shaking down?
I think it's very weak and uncertain at this point. And, you know, Palin attracting media attention with this bus tour is still not the same as Palin mounting a credible and strong presidential campaign. Right now, I think, you know, Romney is still the best the Republicans have. Maybe Tim Pawlenty could put together something, although it's very unclear whether he could challenge the president. And other than that, I think Republicans are much stronger when thinking about 2016 rather than 2012.
Heading into the 2012 election year, could fear of Medicare change and other safety net and stimulus changes under Republicans outweigh dissatisfaction with what is clearly anemic economic recovery that Obama can only argue would have been much worse without his efforts?
Absolutely. I mean, the fact is people in America don't like government, but they like government programs. And I think the harder Republicans push on specific cuts on programs like Medicare and Social Security, they discover and learn, as they have before, that Americans like those programs. And so that, I think, undercuts Republican strength. And I think, you know, Obama does have a case he can make that the situation would have been much worse without the kind of programs he put forward. So, again, this is going to come down to Republicans having some plan and vision rather than just being anti-Obama.
Julian Zelizer is Princeton University Professor of History and Public Affairs. His books include Arsenal of Democracy, Jimmy Carter, and The Presidency of George W. Bush.
Quote from the news, "I need more than a month for these monstrous words, the ones that I've never heard before." That was former Bosnian Serb Army Chief Ratko Mladic, a fugitive for 15 years, on finally facing charges of genocide at a UN war crimes tribunal in The Hague. He suggested he was only defending his country and his people.
Next, lessons from Vietnam for America's wars today, for your ears only. We're back for your ears only. I'm Alyssa Axelberth.
And I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. It is very worrying. I have no idea what to eat anymore. That was Sarah Witter, a student in Cologne, Germany, on a new highly toxic strain of E. coli that has infected over 1,500 people, mostly in Germany, and killed at least 17. Scientists initially blamed tainted Spanish cucumbers, but later admitted the source was unknown. Now this.
I was following the governor when he called me and said, come faster. And when he called, suddenly a big explosion happened. We don't know how it happened and who did it. We lost our vision.
Taliban forces in Afghanistan last week battled British troops and staged a suicide attack that killed an Afghan security chief, as one survivor recounted for Al Jazeera English. And NATO forces prepared for escalating violence in another summer offensive, encouraged now by plans for the start of an Allied drawdown. The deaths of 110 coalition troops in April and May were already a record for those 2 months in almost 10 years of war with Islamist extremists.
In Iraq, too, roadside bombings and suicide attacks continued as internal rivalries followed the withdrawal of most U.S. troops, dramatizing the complex mix of motivations that fuel violence and terrorism in the region. Understanding the mind of our enemy has never been more important, says retired Marine Lieutenant Colonel James G. Zumwalt, a Vietnam and Gulf War veteran whose family has served in every conflict since the American Revolution. Tragically, his brother died of cancer linked to the Agent Orange defoliant sprayed in Vietnam on orders of their father, Vice Admiral Elmo Zumwalt, youngest ever chief of naval operations.
Initially, James Zumwalt's reaction was anger at the Vietnamese enemy, but he subsequently became sensitive to the losses suffered by the Vietnamese as well, and to the psychology that had driven them so successfully in the first war America could not be said to have won. His book about it is Bare Feet, Iron Will, Stories from the Other Side of Vietnam's Battlefields from Fortis Publishers. And to discuss its lessons for current conflicts, for your ears only, we're pleased to have James Zumwalt on the line now. Welcome to our show.
Thank you very much, David. It's a pleasure to be here.
It was traveling to post-war Vietnam with your late father about the Agent Orange problems that led to your change of heart on your former enemies there, specifically talking with a Vietnamese general who also lost a brother. Tell us how that affected you.
I had been talking to the general in a one-on-one conversation about the war and its impact, and when he shared that with me, it was kind of like a light went on. I asked myself, was the loss of a loved one any less significant just because it occurred on the other side of the battlefield? And the answer was obviously no. This was something that was devastating to both of us.
You ended up making 50 return visits. What kind of people did you interview?
Mostly veterans involved in all aspects of the war, pilots, communication personnel, members of both the North Vietnamese Army and the Viet Cong forces. Also, many civilians, mothers who had lost several sons in the conflict.
And what did you learn about the Vietnamese psychology that you wish you and other Americans had known before we escalated our military involvement there?
The one thing that really became crystal clear to me was their creativity and ingenuity. They basically had a skill at causing us not to see things on the battlefield that were there and to see things there that weren't. In the first category, We knew where parts of the Ho Chi Minh Trail were, but we did not know where all the legs of the trail were. So we would look at rivers because we knew they had to be crossing rivers at points. They knew we knew this, and so they would build bridges for the sole purpose of us having a target to attack. Unbeknownst to us, either several miles up or downstream from that bridge, they had a system of what they called submarine bridges. And a submarine bridge was a bridge platform that was built about a foot and a half under the low water mark. And for those people who are familiar with the waterways in Vietnam, it's called brown water for a reason. You can't see anything under the surface. And an example of things they caused us to see that were there that weren't, the Coochie Tunnels was an extensive tunnel network in the southern part of Vietnam, about 30 miles outside of Saigon. It was a network of tunnels about 320 kilometers. They, digging this massive tunnel system, they had a problem with what to do with all the extra dirt. Where possible, they would scatter it in the jungle. If there was a B-52 crater, they would fill a B-52 crater with the excess dirt. But there were times, too, when they just had piles of dirt, and so they had some of their more artistic soldiers take this dirt and actually make termite mounds out of it. So from the air, you would see numerous termite mounds, but you wouldn't. It didn't look like anything unnatural, so we just passed it over.
How do you compare the psychology of the Vietnamese fighting forces with that of the Islamist enemy we face today?
I'd say it's very different. In interviewing the hundreds of Vietnamese veterans that I interviewed, it was clear that their motivation was not too different than ours. They wanted to fight the war, they wanted to win, they wanted to survive, and they wanted to return to their loved ones and pursue a livelihood. That's exactly what we wanted to do. Comparing that to the enemy we're fighting today, he doesn't necessarily have a desire to survive on the battlefield because he sees death as a vehicle by which he will go to the afterlife and reap his rewards. I think another difference, too, is when we lost the war in Vietnam, we weren't worried about the Vietnamese following us home. If we lose the war in Afghanistan and Iraq, that is a very real problem.
Do you distinguish between a group like the Afghan Taliban, mostly wanting to control their own country, and al-Qaeda groups with a larger anti-Western terrorist agenda?
There's a common link. Both of them look to employ or apply strict Sharia law. I think the big difference is that the Taliban looks to do it on a domestic basis. Al-Qaeda looks to do it on an international basis.
How do you see the threat of Al-Qaeda and its offshoots around the world since the elimination of Osama bin Laden, also a high-ranking deputy by drone strike in Pakistan last week?
Well, Al-Qaeda in 2001 was fairly centralized with very extensive financial and communication networks in place. One thing that has happened by the time of Osama bin Laden's death is the fact that we had disrupted this pretty extensively. The bad news is, however, is there are a lot of franchise operations, mom-and-pop operations in place now that require a lot more resources to be able to monitor all these things that are going on.
Where do you stand on the question of aiding the dissident groups throughout the Middle East and North Africa? Some say that will open paths to power for more extremist groups like al-Qaeda, the Muslim Brotherhood.
Well, I think one important thing is to know who it is you're supporting. The thing that concerns me about, for example, Libya, is we don't know the distance. We really don't know whether they are going to be of the strict Sharia mindset or whether they are going to be more open-minded. I think we should not have gotten involved in Libya until we were able to make a clear determination on that. On the other hand, you take a look at Syria. That's a place where you have Assad, the president of Syria, who's basically in bed with Ahmadinejad of Iran. He could not be doing anything more to pursue interests contrary to those of the U.S., and I think that's where we should have gotten involved.
Retired Marine Lieutenant Colonel James Zumwalt is now a private security consultant and a member of the nonpartisan Committee on the Present Danger. His book is Bare Feet, Iron Will, Stories from the Other Side of Vietnam's Battlefields from Fortis Publishers.
Quote from the news, I know every photo I have on my computer, and he should know every photo that he has on his computer. That was a Brooklyn constituent of Democratic Congressman Anthony Weiner ridiculing his reaction to a photo of well-filled underpants sent from Weiner's Twitter account. Weiner contended his account had been hacked, but could not say if the picture was of him.
Next, Condu. Notes from the Big French Film Festival. For your ears only.
We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth with a quote from the news. Freedom doesn't need a dialogue. That was Syrian journalist Louay Hussein dismissing President Bashar al-Assad's formation of a committee to dialogue with dissidents, even as government forces continued their bloody repression. In Yemen, President Ali Abdullah Saleh was injured by an opposition attack on his compound that killed at least three guards and a cleric. Now this.
This is unbelievable. There's no city like this in the world.
You're in love with a fantasy.
I'm in love with you.
There are two ways through life. The way of nature and the way of grace. You have to choose which one you'll follow.
A clip from Woody Allen's new Midnight in Paris, the opening feature at this year's Cannes Film Festival, and another from Terrence Malick's The Tree of Life, winner of the festival's prestigious Palme d'Or Award. Both span centuries for reasons richly comic in the first case and deeply serious in the second. But apart from their respective honors, American films didn't seem to make all that much impression at Cannes. Too formulaic. And Cannes is not a particularly important way station to box office or Oscar success for films made in America.
For more on the Cannes scene, some films seen there and back home for Your Ears Only, we're pleased to be joined again by Boston Globe critic Wesley Morris, recently returned from the festival. Welcome back to our program.
Hello. How are you guys?
Good. First, tell us a bit about the festival this year, the biggest excitement, smallest bikini. What most sticks in your mind about the scene?
It was bound to be a good festival before Lars von Trier showed up, but I think once he showed up, I think it sort of really focused people on what was important about the festival, and it wasn't necessarily his press conference, but it was really his movies, you know, the other movies in the festival, including his, that people probably preferred to talk about. But, I mean, he loomed very large over the festival.
He was the one who gave a press conference that turned into a sort of an anti-Semitic rant, even though he comes from a Jewish family.
Right. Well, I mean, it's very complicated, that press conference and what he was up to. You know, he is a director. He's Danish. He suffers from depression. He makes controversial movies, and he tends to promote them controversially. It's very complicated.
Well, let's talk about his film. What's the name of the film, and how was it? He was booted out.
Melancholia is the name of the film, and fittingly enough, it's a movie about a woman played by Kirsten Dunst suffering from depression, and her depression, the lowest point of her depression happens to coincide with this planet hurtling toward the Earth, threatening to destroy it. It's a really beautiful movie in some ways, and it's one of the strongest films he's made, at least for an hour, just in terms of how focused it is narratively. And Kirsten Dunst, who won the Best Actress Award, is very good. You know, the unfortunate thing about that press conference is actually that it really did overshadow the discussion of the actual quality and strength of his movie making. He's always been a very good filmmaker. I think that he turned a lot of people off with some of his ideas. But I think this is a really, for him, an accessible movie that is also just a work of art that for an hour is a screwball wedding comedy, and for the second hour is a disaster movie, and they're both very good.
Now, Terrence Malick's Tree of Life won the Palme d'Or to the sound of both booing and cheering from the audience. Is that usual, and why in this case?
The Cannes Film Festival is sort of notorious for its booing. The French have no problem booing something they don't like. I don't know if you've been following the French Open. They do a lot of booing there, too. The Tree of Life ended its press screening, you know, totally packed theater, about, I don't know how many people, but, you know, almost maybe more than 500, maybe 1,000. I can never get the numbers right for that theater. But the booing was basically people who sort of thought it was just hokum. They didn't buy any of his ideas. And I think the applause that came after, I mean, what usually happens at the festival is that someone will boo, or there'll be rousing applause, and then there'll be the opposite response to sort of counter that. And in the case of the Malick movie, I think the ideas, I mean, the people who love it sort of love it as a work of art. I think it's hard to love it as a work of ideas, because I don't really know that there are any that are that resonant. But, I mean, to connect with this movie is to sort of experience some kind of spiritual transference between you and the film. Basically, it's sort of about the beginning of the universe, and this sort of microcosm that one family's life makes in the universe. I mean, that idea is good, but I think, you know, from there it becomes this very sort of impressionistic. You know, he's never been a narrative filmmaker, but I mean, he's definitely gotten farther and farther away from narrative filmmaking to the degree that what really makes the films work beyond its imagery is the idea that's holding it together. And in this case, I just don't think there's enough of an idea there.
Let's move from Malick's fifth movie in 38 years to Woody Allen's 41st, Midnight in Paris, about a Hollywood hack who visits Paris and time travels back to the golden 20s there, Hemingway, Cole Porter, Gertrude Stein. Too ridiculous?
No, I think it's actually a sweet movie in some ways. I don't think it's a great movie. In the last 10 years, I don't think it's the best movie he's made in the last 10 years. That's not saying a lot, but I do think that there's a film he made in 2006 or 7 called Cassandra's Dream that I think is actually great. I think that's the best movie he's made in the last couple of years. But the sweetness of this movie is this idea of moving back to what one would think, 80 years removed, 90 years removed is a simpler time. But for the people who lived there, it was anything but simple. It was very complicated. It was emotionally fraught. And some of the people in that period are nostalgic for 60 years before that. Or 40 years before that. It's a really interesting idea about nostalgia and how it doesn't quite add up or satisfy, and that you really should be trying to live in the present, not the past. I mean, for him to be saying this, a man who I think is sort of overly smitten with the past and kind of terrified of the present, it's an interesting conceit. And it's not, I wish that some of his writing in that film were stronger, but I mean, I really think that the idea behind it is actually quite touching.
Boston Globe film critic Wes Morris.
Another quote from the news. This doesn't happen in Massachusetts. That was Bob Horacek, a landlord in the state whose building was one of more than 370 damaged by a freak tornado that killed at least 3 people.
Next, jazz meets country. For your ears only. With more For Your Ears Only, I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. Just shot a man dead, never been so proud. That's a line in the controversial music video about a rape victim's revenge released by Rihanna, who was herself attacked by former companion Chris Brown back in 2009. She said she was helping other victims deal with their pain, but conservative critics said the song promotes violent vengeance. Now this.
They'll be dismissing you. From this heart of mine, they'll lead me safely through the night, and I'll follow as though blind.
Her first recording was a country song, and now jazz great Diane Shore has returned to those roots with a new CD of Nashville classics, The Gathering, released this week by Vanguard. And with the story behind it for your ears only, we're pleased to have Diane Shore on the line with us now. Welcome to our program.
Hi, how are you, dear?
Tell us about that first country recording produced by Jimmy Wakely while you were still in 10th grade in Seattle.
My sister Elizabeth and I went to down to Burbank, California, and stayed at Jimmy Wakely's house in Toluca Lake in 1971, and I was 17 years old. And yes, I was in the 10th grade at that time.
How did he come across you?
I had an audition at the Auburn Elks Club, and Jimmy was performing there, and my father brought me on stage, and I did something, I don't even remember what it was now, but because I'm a few decades have gone by, but he liked what he heard and invited me to come down to their studio, which is also in their home, and Jimmy says, I'm going to make you a country star, and so on. So I went ahead and went down there and recorded 2 sides.
Talk about the music you listened to back home and the singers who were your early inspiration.
Well, I listened to pretty much everything that I could get my hands on, and I listened to a lot of crossover country. They had it even back then, Ray Charles's Born to Lose and I Can't Stop Loving You, and a lot of Roger Miller and and others, Tammy Wynette and so on. And so, but if my influences, the earlier influences were jazz related. Dinah Washington was my biggest influence, as well as Sarah Vaughan and Nancy Wilson. And then, but I listened to other people, Patti Page, you know. I oftentimes would wake up to the Tennessee Waltz and all that kind of stuff, and that was kind of like country-based also. So it's, you know, I just decided to come back to these roots.
Well, how did signing with Vanguard lead to this return to country music at this point?
Well, they produce a lot of bluegrass and so on, and I was thinking of getting into the country, you know, getting back into country-influenced music, and Vanguard seemed to be the most natural course to go.
Who are some of the country stars you assembled to work on this album?
Well, there's two, although there's really wonderful musicians in Nashville, you know. Vince Gill, Alison Krauss are two, then there was another wonderful woman singer. Her last name is Ramsey. You know, she did some background vocals on this too. Eddie Bear's on drums, Mike Rowhouse, Mark Knopfler, I believe the name is pronounced, Martin Taylor. There's just a lot of wonderful musicians. They can play anything.
How did you choose the 10 songs on this album, including Willie Nelson's Healing Hands of Time, of which we heard a bit at the top of the segment?
Well, Steve Buckingham, my producer, handpicked these songs. We started out with about 21 tunes and then went our way down to 10. And he just, you know, he went ahead and sent me MP3s of all these different songs, and I went ahead and picked the ones that I really liked.
I gather you recorded almost all of the new album in a single day in Nashville. Is that usual for your CDs?
No. To be honest with you, it can take up to about a week sometimes, but I just was so at home with this material, it didn't take me very long at all.
You've said you couldn't do justice to these songs when you were younger. Why?
I think because life experience, I hadn't had life experience as far as, just dealing with the ups and downs of life. I think it takes a certain amount of maturity to deal with that. And when I get into a studio, I think all vocalists become actors or actresses to a certain extent as far as being able to relate to a lyric of what is sung.
And how do you think your jazz background influences your interpretation of these country classics?
I think I think it represents them a lot. I mean, for instance, like in Today I Started Loving You Again, I don't think anybody in the history of country music has ever scatted to a country song, and I think I'm probably among the first.
How do you compare country music generally to your usual jazz repertoire in the Great American Songbook of Gershwin, Berlin, Porter, Rogers, Hammerstein, Arlen, Mercer, those guys?
Well, let me put it to you simply. In country music, there's a few more triads. You know what triads are, don't you?
Yes.
For those of you who may not know, it's three chords together. Like, for instance, a G, a B, and a D, or, you know, and then, of course, there's seventh chords. But, you know, the comparison is that every song, no matter what genre it's in, is a storyline, has a story to tell. And it does it in jazz as well, you know, like the wonderful jazz ballads and so on. But there's something about a country song that really delivers it, I mean, so poignantly.
Two-time Grammy winner Diane Shore's new album of country songs is The Gathering from Vanguard Records this week, including the Merle Haggard classic she just mentioned.
I got over you just long enough to let my heartache mend. Then today I started loving you again.
Next, The Madness of King Bobby, a documentary on chess master Bobby Fischer, for your ears only. We have more for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth with a quote from the news. I will regret for the rest of my life the pain and the harm that I've done, but I did not break the law and I never, ever thought I was. That was two-time Democratic presidential candidate John Edwards promising to fight his federal indictment on charges of violating campaign finance law to cover up an extramarital affair, at least on the grounds of intent. Now this.
Bobby Fischer was wiping away his opposition.
He penetrated the secrets of chess. He was the best player who ever lived.
What would your ultimate aim be?
Well, I'd like to be a world champion. You keep it for 20 years or so.
A good chess player is paranoid on the board, but then if you take that paranoia to real life, it doesn't play so well.
From the new HBO documentary, Bobby Fischer Against the World, which makes its TV debut Monday with repeats through the month. Conceived and directed by Oscar nominee and Emmy winner Liz Garbus, the film makes use of old footage, previously unseen documents, and interviews with friends, colleagues, and competitors of the youngest chess grandmaster ever. Fischer pumped new life and lives into the game before the obsession that drove him finally drove him over the edge. A fugitive from federal charges, finally living and dying in Iceland, where in 1972 he had won his wish for the world championship in an extended match carried by TV worldwide.
At one point, the young chess genius is asked if he's practicing psychological warfare against Boris Spassky, the Russian world champion he eventually beat. He says he's not interested in psychology, only good moves. But the film shows many psychological themes that played through Fischer's life, the longing for privacy and mixed blessings of celebrity, the power of passion and paranoia. The Cold War thinking that had no less a light than Henry Kissinger making Fischer a pawn to give American democracy a psychological win over Soviet communism in what, ironically, is often called the Game of Kings.
Joining us now for Your Ears Only is one of the key sources in the Garbus film. He's retired Dr. Anthony Sadie, an international chess master who played against the youthful Fischer, later put him up at his New York home while Fischer played a delaying game before finally winging to that world championship match in Iceland. Welcome to our show.
Hi.
How old was Bobby when you first played chess, and what was your reaction to him at first?
He was about eight, and he started to get noticed at the Manhattan Chess Club. I was 6 years older.
How did your relationship develop over those early years?
His mother thought I was sort of a solid influence, and she used me to influence the boy.
Asked once about his life away from chess, he said chess was his life. Can you recall any interest in sports, music, girls as he grew older?
He definitely was a rock and roll fan. Girls and sports, not so much.
In retrospect, were there signs his chess obsession might become mental imbalance?
He had his quirks as a kid, but nobody could suspect the degree to which it would develop later in life.
In preparation for the championship, he worked with an athletic trainer as if for a marathon. Is that kind of preparation common at the highest levels of chess, or?
Well, in the Soviet Union, they perfected chess preparation. And yes, physical training was very much part of it. We know that a tough chess match will take pounds off a competitor, for example.
Do you think the publicity over that preparation also sort of helped make him a national hero and an icon in a way that people who were not intimate of chess or intimates of chess could respect as well?
I think the key to his instant fame was the fact that we had a rip-roaring Cold War on between the United States and the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union was superior to us in a couple of fields, and chess was one of them.
He lived with you in that run-up to the Iceland match. What was your sense of his motivation for delay?
He appeared to be very ambivalent. He certainly wanted to go and play and win the world title, and he also didn't want to go. It was from moment to moment in his mind.
Why would he not want to go when he'd said that was always his dream?
In his mind, losing a chess game was sort of a death, and he couldn't face that. He once said, I don't even want to think about losing.
So I guess that explains his decision not to defend his title against another Russian in 1975, forfeiting rather than risking being beaten.
Yes, most of us feel that he didn't want to risk the possibility of ever losing. But of course, he had very good arguments about conditions. And oddly enough, the International Chess Federation, which rejected his arguments in a given year, would accept them in a future year. And that went on and on. And finally, his rules became generally accepted.
It was agreeing to a rematch with Spassky 20 years later that made Fischer a fugitive because he violated a U.S. embargo against Yugoslavia, where the games were played. Was being declared a lawbreaker the trigger for his increasing anti-Americanism and anti-Semitism, or the product of it? And was he already seeing himself as a martyr, as best as you could understand him?
Well, let's study the phenomenon of paranoia. It's in books. We know all about it. And it starts with thinking that some small group is conspiring against you. But when it develops full-blown, you think everybody is against you. It's a sad condition. I can't tell you exactly how he developed it.
Dr. Anthony Sadie is an international chess master, an early friend of Bobby Fischer, as seen in the documentary Bobby Fischer Against the World on HBO starting Monday, June 6th.
They're screaming and crying at the YMCA. Bobby, Bobby, why'd you go away? His mother's whispering wide and low. Bobby, Bobby, where did you go?
And this has been For Your Ears Only.
Time for one more news quote. It was peaceful. He didn't feel a thing. That was Mayor Morgenroth, lawyer for assisted suicide pioneer Jack Kevorkian on Dr. Death's Death from Natural Causes at age 83.
For Your Ears Only is online anytime at iTunes, News and Politics, or podcastbunker.com. But to continue, we need your tax-deductible donations or foundation grants. Please email david.ears.only@gmail.com.
This broadcast was engineered by Chad Daly and Noriko Okabe at Argo Studios with intern Kate McGee. I'm Melissa Axelberg.
I'm David Alpern. For Your Ears Only is a production of Gatewave Incorporated, a 24/7 nonprofit radio reading service bringing vital information and enrichment to those who can't see.
Now we're back with another archive segment, a major story on this show a year ago.
This week last year, we conducted a post-mortem on Israel's deadly interdiction of a humanitarian flotilla aiming to break its blockade of Gaza. 9 activists aboard the lead ship Mavi Marmara were killed. From our June 6, 2010 broadcast, hosted by Isaac Davy Aronson and me.
Everything must be done to prevent another incident of this kind. All concerned should act with a sense of care and responsibility and in accordance with international law.
Hamas is smuggling thousands of Iranian rockets, missiles, and other weaponry, smuggling it into Gaza in order to fire on Israel's cities.
There was chaos last week and 9 dead civilians after Israeli commandos in international waters raided a Turkish ship carrying pro-Palestinian activists and supplies for Gaza. The Mavi Marmara was part of a 6-ship flotilla meant to break Israel's continuing blockade of Gaza and its extremist Hamas government, or at least make Jerusalem pay a steeper price in the new battlefield of public opinion. that it succeeded was dramatized by worldwide condemnation, like UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon's, despite the self-defense defense mounted by Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
The incident further strained Israel's international relations at a time it seeks additional support against the nuclear intentions of Iran, which last week was reported to have possibly produced enough enriched uranium for 2 atomic weapons. For our discussion of the episode and its implications, we have Daniel Pipes, director of the Middle East Forum and danielpipes.org, as well as Aaron David Miller, public policy scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center. His latest book is The Much Too Promised Land, America's Elusive Search for Arab-Israeli Peace, from Bantam.
First to Daniel Pipes. Welcome to For Your Ears Only.
Thank you.
You say the high seas raid with commandos attacked as they slid down ropes from helicopters showed that Israel has not mastered the new rules of irregular warfare on the battlefield of public perception. What are those rules?
The way to see the current battles between Israel and its opponents is that it's more like a police operation than a military campaign. In a military campaign, classically, you don't know the outcome. To take the Arab-Israeli conflict in 1967 or 73, no one knew how it would come out. But since 1982, including this last week's episode, you know how it's going to come out. You know who's going to win. You know who's going to lose. And therefore, the focus is not on victory and defeat. The focus is on how it's done. Is there collateral damage? Were the rules followed? And so forth. And the Israelis need to understand, as we do, as any powerful state does, that you can't harm a ragtag opposition. You have to treat them very carefully. And so the Israelis made an immense tactical mistake. Now, I differentiate that from the moral issue, which I think, you know, Israel's perfectly entitled to protect itself. But tactically, they made grievous errors.
Some ships in the flotilla were boarded peacefully at night by commandos in small boats who took control before passengers could react. Afterwards, Israel seemed to acknowledge that protection against arms smuggling could also come from better inspections of cargo before it leaves or after arrival in Gaza, perhaps with international assistance. Are these better tactics for legitimate prevention of more attacks from Gaza while easing pressure on the people there?
They certainly are. They could be others as well. They could maybe have anchored this ship, or they could have towed it. There are many. I mean, I'm not a specialist in either naval warfare nor international law. I just know that what the Israelis did was a great blunder, and I hope they've learned from it and they don't repeat it as the next attempts are made, that they understand, not just on these high seas confrontations, but more broadly, that the battle for public opinion is the key. It's not the bullets are not the issue these days so much as op-eds.
And that goes for the larger blockade of Gaza, the treatment of Gaza and the people there, which has come under such scrutiny from international bodies.
This is a very complex question. The Israeli relationship with Gaza is extremely complex. The amount of food and what is and is not available in Gaza is extremely complex. But if one were to briefly summarize it, one would say that Israel is provisioning its enemy, and there is plentiful food in Gaza. Not everywhere at all times, but basically that's the situation. Why the Israelis are doing it, what they have in mind, I couldn't tell you. But it is not simply a matter of a million-plus people under siege and not having enough to eat. No. It's much more complex politically and economically than that.
Daniel Pipes of the Middle East Forum, next to veteran Mideast diplomat and advisor Aaron David Miller. Welcome back to our program.
Pleasure to be here.
In one commentary last week, you wrote that Hamas can't be bought or broken. So how do you see Israel dealing with the threat it represents and trying for some peaceful status quo?
It won't be easy. Because essentially what you have is an ongoing struggle, which has a political, military, and security, and now informational component, in essentially an asymmetrical war. And until the problem of the Palestinian Humpty Dumpty is resolved, that is to say, the Palestinian National Movement identifies a coherent, cohesive, and effective strategy to advance Palestinian national aspirations, until that is remedied, it strikes me that the Gaza-Ramallah disconnect and all of the complexities that come with it, including the latest crisis in Gaza, is going to continue at some level.
What about the idea of more international inspections to allow more non-military material into Gaza for a more normal life there?
Well, sure. I mean, look, there are any number of fixes that could be instituted if, in fact, the objective was known or shared by the government of Israel. But the problem here is that the government of Israel believes, that it is involved in a ongoing confrontation, not just with respect to the importation of high-trajectory weapons, which Hamas imports largely through the tunnels, which is not terribly efficient, but it's certainly re-energized and re-equipped their stockpile. But the Israelis are involved in a campaign to delegitimize and prevent Hamas from growing stronger. So, you know, it's not just a narrow Israeli goal to avoid or to staunch weapons flow. It's literally an effort to delegitimize, and quite paradoxically, of course, it has the opposite effect. Hamas is hurting, but its role and influence in Gaza is ironclad, in large part because, I would argue, in part because Gaza can't breathe, and the local population is essentially dependent, hostage, not just to Israel's own blockade, but to Hamas's policies. So you end up with a situation, frankly, if you increased aid, you run the risks of bucking up Hamas and giving them a victory. If you continue the boycott, you end up in a situation in which you're making the population suffer, anger and rage grows, and the Palestinians become more dependent on Hamas. So I don't think that's the issue. The question in the end is, for there to be stability in Palestine and a successful Israeli-Palestinian negotiation that leads to an enduring agreement, you're going to have one Palestinian interlocutor who controls all of the guns of Palestine and is prepared to silence them in return for a deal, and one negotiating position. And you don't have that. In fact, the chances of getting that right now are essentially slim to none. So I don't see much hope for the long term. There will be fixes to this current crisis, I think, that may improve somewhat the flow of material, not just humanitarian aid, by the way. But it won't lead to a satisfactory solution for anyone.
Aaron David Miller is a veteran Mideast diplomat and advisor, now a public policy scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center. His latest book is The Much Too Promised Land, America's Elusive Search for Arab-Israeli Peace, from Bantam. We also heard from Daniel Pipes, director of the Middle East Forum, and danielpipes.org.
Flotilla fiasco. From our June 6, 2010 broadcast, a day before the one-year anniversary of the incident last week, international activists unveiled plans for a repeat flotilla with 1,500 participants from about 100 nations, and including an American contingent with an 86-year-old Holocaust survivor, as well as a former captain in the Israeli Air Force who previously refused to fly missions over Gaza. Israeli forces are making special preparations to avoid the critical coverage in 2010. Egypt, meanwhile, has reopened border crossings to Gaza, and underground tunnels continue to provide access for various materials and munitions. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern. We'll visit the archive again next week.